Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, Barbara Allman will talk about the big taboo, feelings of ambivalence over motherhood. Also, abortion surges to become a number one issue, even as people pretend it's not, and a baby kidnapping highlights this rare problem. Liza Donnelly did a great TED talk about humor and feminism.
I was afraid of womanhood. Not that I'm not afraid now, but I've learned to pretend. I've learned to be flexible. In fact, I've developed some interesting tools to help me deal with this fear. Let me explain. Back in the 50s and 60s, when I was growing up, little girls were supposed to be kind and thoughtful and pretty and gentle and soft. And we were supposed to fit into roles that were sort of shadowy, really not quite clear what we were supposed to be. There were plenty of role models all around us. We had our mothers, our aunts, our cousins, our sisters, and of course the ever-present media bombarding us with images and words telling us how to be.
It's worth watching since the laughs are mostly from cartoons she drew for the PowerPoint. Thomas Frank famously suggested in his book, What's the Matter with Kansas?, that social conservatives are being hoodwinked by abortion, that they're voting for bans on abortion and instead getting screwed economically. I think his book has a lot of insights, but on this he was wrong. His assumption was that populist conservatives aren't interested in destroying the social safety net, and that was wrong. And his assumption that conservative leadership isn't out to dismantle reproductive rights? Totally wrong. I don't think there's a hoodwink going on here. There's a whole cloth, screw everyone kind of conservatism, and we'd be remiss in not acknowledging these realities. And, as if to prove this, the newly elected Republican leadership in the House went straight after restricting abortion access. It was literally the third item of business.
Today we're here to talk about another promise that we're keeping, and that is ensuring that tax dollars are never used to fund elective abortions. A ban on taxpayer funding of abortions is the will of the people, and it ought to be the will of the land. The current law, particularly as enforced by this administration, does not reflect the will of the American people. Last year, we listened to the American people through America Speaking Out. They spoke on this issue loudly and clearly.
Boehner is lying. There are no taxpayer-funded abortions. What they're doing is trying to make it so that you can't buy insurance from anyone who offers abortion insurance, or you'll lose your tax credit. As a law, it wouldn't have much of an effect. The Stupak compromise already made it likely most insurance companies will just drop any insurance coverage for abortion altogether. But this is about making sure that this has to happen no matter what. Basically, any opportunity to grandstand about abortion and imply that women who get abortions are dirty sluts who shouldn't be allowed to even touch the same money as everyone else is an opportunity that conservatives are going to take. I suppose Frank would say this is just another example of the Republicans throwing a symbolic victory to their base. This bill will stall out after it's passed, but it's also setting a precedent of defining taxpayer funding way out of any lines drawn before. I wouldn't be surprised if Republicans start claiming that it's taxpayer funding if a woman who has an abortion gets a tax deduction on her mortgage, or if she drives on federal highways. The idea is setting up women who have abortions as a class who are officially too filthy to have even symbolic contact with others. Even though the Tea Party has been claimed by the mainstream media to be all about taxes and spending and not social conservatism, in fact, this was red meat thrown directly to them. Tea Party leader Mike Pence was all over this bill, where he laid out clearly that controlling female sexuality was a priority over economic issues.
We gather to mark the 38th anniversary of the worst Supreme Court decision since Dred Scott. Amen. But we gather with hope in the shadow of a new pro-life majority on Capitol Hill. Yeah. These are trying times in the life of our nation. Our economy is struggling and our national government is awash in a sea of debt. And amidst these struggles, some would have us focus our energy on jobs and spending. But as you attest today by your presence, you know, we must not remain silent when great moral battles are being waged.
Honestly, the fact of a bad economy may just be making anti-choice sentiment worse for some on the right. They tend to react to anxiety by doubling down their hatred and resentment of others. And women who are perceived as getting away with having sex are at the top of that list. Unfortunately, the social conservatism of the Tea Party doesn't fit the narrative that's been laid down by most of the media. And so coverage of this astounding turn of events has been slim. The one exception, of course, was Rachel Maddow. Isn't it always?
The American people are saying is jobs. They're spelling it jobs, J-O-B-S, jobs. A funny thing happened on the way to what Republicans are calling job one. Republicans spent last week flexing their new majority on a quixotic symbolic repeal of health reform, which, of course, they called job killing, even though it's no such thing. And it, in fact, cuts the deficit, which the Republicans themselves say is how you make more jobs, at least some of the time. Then Republicans turned their attention immediately from that time waster to American women, specifically to American women's uteruses, with not one but two bills designed to make sure the government does not do something it already doesn't do, and that's to not spend money on abortion.
So it's basically the opposite of Frank's formulation from years ago. People vote for jobs and they get a tax on abortion rights. Sure, it's red meat being thrown to a misogynist base, but that doesn't matter. We need to stop pretending people who campaign against women's rights don't take their job of rolling back women's rights seriously. They take it more seriously than pretty much anything else.
I'd like to welcome Barbara Allman to the program. Barbara is a psychotherapist, a member of the faculty at the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis, and an adjunct clinical assistant professor at Stanford University. She has a new book out called The Monster Within, The Hidden Side of Motherhood, and she's here today to talk about her book and about maternal ambivalence. Welcome to RealityCast, Barbara.
Thank you.
Let's start with defining the term in play. What is maternal ambivalence?
Well, ambivalence itself is a word that describes the mixed feelings, positive and negative, that all of us have towards anyone or anything that's extremely important to us in our lives. Because you can't love someone without then being worried that you might lose them, that they might not love you back, that they might disappoint you. And this is true of mothers and children and really all human relationships. And the negative side of ambivalence, where one feels impatience, anger, a wish to be out of the whole business for a while, is a normal phenomenon. But in our society these days, it has a very bad press. Mothers are expected to always be positive towards their children, and I don't think it's possible, you know.
So would you say that women who have feelings of negativity, of frustration, of anger, mm-hmm. and resentment to their children on occasion just have no space to express that at all?
Well, I'm saying that it's hard to express it publicly without making other mothers anxious about it. What I'm saying is that the expectation is these days, more than previously at any time in my lifetime, which, you know, spans quite a few decades by now, the expectation is that one will always provide everything, not be angry, be understanding, you know, follow the current fashions in child rearing. And the fact of the matter is that that can't always be done, and that it's very hard to talk about the hidden side of motherhood, the angry feelings, the feelings of needing time off, of wondering whether one should have had children in the first place, of a whole variety from rather mild to fairly serious negative feelings exist and coexist with positive feelings. But those are not a problem.
Why do you think now more than ever there is so much pressure on mothers to always be upbeat, to never express or feel even frustration, anger, or even wanting a day off?
Well, I think this is a development that I think is one of the last, let's say, 15 to 20 years. I kind of associate it with the perfectionism of the baby boomers as they became parents, and some reaction to the feminist movement, in which it was considered admirable to both work and have children, or work and not have children. Women were expected or encouraged to liberate themselves from the home and from the obligations, of motherhood. But of course, mothers, women also want babies. Many of them don't just want to go to work. They want babies, and they want them fairly powerfully. And it became hard for women who were working long periods of time to be away from their children. And it was kind of what you might call a reversal in attitude, that led to this kind of, I don't really know what to call it. People have used the term helicopter mom, extreme vigilance about everything the child does and has and says and eats. And women have always followed the current fashions in child rearing, but the current fashions in child rearing have changed enormously over the decades. And children now are monitored extremely closely, are expected to do a large number of after-school activities. Now, I should add that I'm now talking mainly about the middle and upper middle and upper classes, because working class women have to work. The survival of their children depends on their being able to earn a living, or working class families, and they don't have the extra money for cello lessons and soccer and this and that. I mean, not that these aren't good things, they're wonderful things, but the child's whole life is taken up. In the neighborhood I live in, I see children, older children being taken to school by their parents. They all ride their bikes together, lest they be kidnapped. I see children, toting large backpacks, or sometimes, suitcases on wheels with all their various equipment for the activities of the day. And while there's something quite admirable about it, I, think of sort of the loss of the chance for free play and imagination and, a development of one's own interests and one's own versions of reality.
Do you think that the concept of choice and the newness of it has anything to do with this?
Well, I think it is and it isn't. It's been since the late 20s, early 30s, when effective birth control became available, the work of Margaret Sanger, women have been able to make those choices. I mean, presumably the husband is involved in the choice also. But I think what you're talking about is that it's now acceptable for women to not have children. And so that choice is, that they cannot have children and there doesn't have to be an excuse. They can simply not want them. They can simply say that they have other things that are more important to them in life. But I think that for many women, it's not so easy to choose one way or the other. And women who give themselves to their careers, often regret later that they didn't have children or that they didn't have more children. Some women regret that they had as many children as they had because it takes up their entire lives. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it's true. I think choices are such definitive things, and they erase the reality of ambivalence.
Well, they... No, I think ambivalence figures into choices.
Yeah.
You know, if you have no choice, naturally there's going to be some resentment. But even having choice, you can feel ambivalent about choosing either way, to not have children or to have them. The point being that ambivalence is a normal phenomenon, and it's a ubiquitous phenomenon, but it's a terribly difficult phenomenon to talk about publicly these days. And I can add one more thing. I had a terrible time getting this book published because...
Really?
Because editors felt this is too disturbing a subject. Write something else.
Just the idea that mothers sometimes experience ambivalence?
That they experience the negative side of ambivalence. That sometimes mothers hate their children or are exhausted by their children or wish they never had children. It usually doesn't last long, and they almost always feel too badly about it. They don't. It's hard for them to see that it's a normal phenomenon.
When you actually argue in the book that it's good for children that their mothers aren't always a fount of unending bliss and generosity. Why is that?
Well, I think that if a mother reads a child so accurately and gratifies its every need accurately, the child has no sense or has a depleted sense of will and choice. And I think that children learn to think and to reason when their every need is not immediately met and correctly met all the time.
So, one good thing about your book is you have a very healing point of view. How should women cope when they have maternal ambivalence, and of course all women, all mothers are going to, and the guilt that results from having negative feelings at times towards your children?
Yeah. Well, the coping depends on the seriousness of the problem. You know, if mothers... And I think this is, by the way, changing these days. It probably was worse 5 to 10 years ago, but that mothers, you know, can talk to other mothers, if they'll be frank with each other. Mothers can talk to other family members. Mothers can get help from pediatricians, nurses, lactation consultants. But if those measures don't really make enough impact, I think it becomes time sometimes to call in a professional, a therapist, someone who can listen without judging negatively, someone who will give the mother the feeling that she's not a monster. You know, part of the title, The Monster Within, really refers to mothers' feelings of them being monsters because they're not always happy with their children and they're not always patient with their children, you know. And if it becomes, you know, serious enough that the mother becomes really depressed or very anxious and can't function, then I think some professional help is indicated, you know, and that kind of help can be quite intensive or sometimes brief and, you know, not so intensive. And I have many examples of that in the book that, you know, come from my own experiences over the years, as well as examples from literature, since I'm a committed reader. I've, you know, come across lots of very good examples of the struggles of mothers within literary works.
So you bring in literary examples to make it more interesting read, but also is there other reasons to do it?
Yes, I think there is another very important reason to do it, that writers write from their unconscious as well as their conscious minds. and they often can say things because they're saying them about fictional characters that they would not be able to say about themselves or say in, you know, in real life. And so very often, and I think we read, among other reasons, to find out how other people cope with the things that trouble us. And in reading it as part of a novel, it's like children in fairy tales. You know, you get a lot of relief from other people's solutions, relief and reassurance. And some of the novels that I deal with are extraordinarily powerful, you know, in terms of the kinds of issues that they deal with. Not just Rosemary's Baby and The Bad Seed, which, you know, which are not bad examples. Frankenstein and Dracula, The Tin Drum, beloved Toni Morrison's wonderful novel, Mona Simpson's Anywhere But Here. These are some of the novels that I discuss, some in a more lengthy way than others, that reflect some of the same problems that my patients deal with and that all women deal with.
My guest today has been Barbara Allman, and her book is called The Monster Within, The Hidden Side of Motherhood. It's out on the University of California Press and available online and at your local bookstore. Thank you so much for coming on to RealityCast, Barbara.
Thank you.
It's got to be one of the most depressing, heartwarming tales that has been brought to the public attention in a while. It started off mostly as a heart tugger of a missing child reunited with a family that hasn't seen her since she was a baby.
In 1987, Carlina White, just 19 days old at the time, was snatched from this hospital.
Oh, she's all right. Love God, I hope she's taking good care of my baby.
The family believes she was abducted by a woman disguised as a nurse who had recently lost her own baby. Carlina was taken to Connecticut, where she was given a new name, Nedra Nance, and a new life, reportedly raised by this woman.
I just hope that the officials be able to get...
And it had a really interesting, cool component, which is that the kidnapped baby, now a 23-year-old woman, figured it out all on her own.
This miraculous reunion, the result of Carlina's own suspicions. When the woman she thought was her mother couldn't provide a birth certificate, she did her own detective work.
I just started typing in Yahoo and Google, like, different articles, like, anything that pulled up in 1987, which any child missing. And the baby picture just struck me because looking at it, it looked like my daughter.
She's talking about this photo found on a missing children's website, along with a composite of how that baby might look today. It was like looking in a mirror.
And for a number of days, this was basically how the story was put to the public. It was all hugs and tears and happiness and completeness. But there were lingering questions you'd have to be a fool to ignore. The big one is, who raised this woman for all these years? Was she the same person who did the kidnapping? Why would she do it? Why would Carlina White be so suspicious of the woman who raised her? There are a lot of questions that are, unfortunately, going to make a lot of people really uneasy. And the answers quickly came to light.
Carlina White may finally get the answers she's been so desperately searching for. Ann Petway, the woman Carlina claims abducted her 23 years ago and raised as her own, turned herself in Sunday to this FBI office in Bridgeport, Connecticut. She reportedly contacted the authorities through Facebook.
Baby kidnappings are relatively rare, at least stranger kidnappings like this are. They fit into a pretty standard profile, which Ann Petway fits at least to some degree. It's usually women of childbearing age, and they're usually in troubled relationships with men, relationships that feature husbands or boyfriends denigrating them for failing to produce a baby. I don't know if that's true of Petway, but what is true is that she had a number of miscarriages and she resorted to baby snatching so that she could feel like she was a mother. That this happens at all should give us pause. Because as rare as it is, this is an example of how bad gender essentialism regarding women can get. It's more than the anti-choice movement that is motivated by this notion that being a mother is every woman's destiny and highest honor, and that women who don't do this are failures. Infertility is made more painful because of this gender essentialism. And sometimes women get so desperate to prove themselves worthy women that they steal babies. If we lived in a world where motherhood was not pushed as some all-consuming thing that defines a woman, but just one aspect of a complex identity, perhaps this sort of thing wouldn't happen so much. That said, baby snatching is incredibly rare. The chance of it happening is actually less than that of having your baby struck by lightning. People do not want your baby. Unfortunately, the response to this story has been to do news stories that imply that there's a real chance that your baby is going to disappear if you blink too fast.
First of all, you should remember that more than half the time, the baby is taken from the mother's room. Now, it does, they are taken from the nursery sometimes, but most of the time it's taken
it's
from the mother's
room. Amazing they can pull it off.
Yes, and so what you want to do is that, you know, moms think, okay, I'll just go to the, you know, the baby's with me, I'm just going to go use the bathroom. But don't do that. If you have to go to the bathroom, even for a second, call the nurse and say, could you please come take the baby or sit with the baby while I go to the restroom. Also, anyone who comes for your baby, ask for their ID. I mean, I know, I have four children. There's like tons of people coming in and out, but ask for the ID. And then also be careful with tests. If someone says, I'm going to take your baby for a test, ask, well, what test is that? Especially if no one told you the baby needed a test.
Sure.
You know, what test is that? Can I see your ID? Who ordered this test? I mean, and also anyone who you don't recognize, because babies are assigned nurses. And if this isn't your baby's nurse, you should be asking
questions.
Yeah,
and it's so easy to just pick up a nurse.
In this segment, they do note that it's rare, but they don't talk about the unintended side effect of the heightened surveillance at hospitals, which is that baby snatchers have changed strategies. A few years ago, almost all baby snatching was walk in the hospital and walk out sorts of things. In the vast majority of those cases, the kidnapper is caught swiftly and the harm is minimal. But now that it's harder to do that, what's gone up is baby snatchers are attacking new mothers and pregnant women to steal their babies. So the price that's being paid is more murders. Somewhere near due pregnant women are killed and the babies are cut out of them. I'm unconvinced that this is a price worth paying to stop a crime that's actually pretty rare. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, reading makes your pee-pee fall off edition. Or, at least that seems to be the basic thrust, no pun intended, of Rush Limbaugh's latest gambit.
I would maintain that one of the reasons that men are quitting is that universities are being turned into chickification factories. They just don't, there's nothing there for them, as has been chronicled.
Much of his show recently has been about listing the various things that would totally turn red-blooded American men into women, which are obviously, in his opinion, the worst things you can be. Education is up there, but he's also been ranting about vegetables and how awful they are. He apparently wants his audience to be ignorant and unhealthy and to die young, but, you know, feeling manly all the way.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.